the story of the prodigal son or the story of the two lost sons. Luke 15 is one of the most significant chapters in all of the scriptures, for it reveals to us the heart of our Heavenly Father. And it's been quite a journey, hasn't it, these last 4 weeks, as we've sat in Luke 15 and listened to what our Father has wanted to say to us. Mostly, we knew the story as the story of the prodigal son, the younger brother who wandered off, so well captured in that video. But we have been introduced to the other lost son. We've been introduced to the older brother. And it's been fascinating as I've watched, because I've watched the Spirit of God speak to so many. And maybe he spoke to you. Maybe there was a moment like I had last week listening to the other guys preach and thinking, they're doing good. That hurt. Maybe the older brother tendencies are still alive in my own heart. Maybe I am older brother-ish, and maybe you are as well. Jesus has been telling his stories to the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. Remember these guys? The religious black belts. The ones who, in their desire to serve God and to be close to him, work really hard at being good people. They became very, very good people. They associated together in the hope that they could be encourage each other to be pure and holy, because without being pure and holy, no one can see God, the scriptures teach. The bitter irony is that in their desire to draw close to God, they actually separated themselves not just from sin, but also from sinner, and therefore from God. Because as we read in Luke 15, the Son of God, God himself, is not over here. He's sitting with sinners and tax collectors. And it may be that as we've been listening to this, we've discovered that our hearts are a little on the older brotherish side of life. And so you can be left hanging, because Jesus has so drawn us into the story that we get to the end of the story in Luke 15 verse 32. And the father has extended a hand out to the older son, the older brother, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. But we don't know if they come back in. We don't know if they've gone to the feast, because we're supposed to work that out for ourselves. If we discover that we are older brothers or older brother-ish, Jesus wants us to identify, well, will you come back home or not? And I've watched people wrestle with that question over the last few weeks, and some have even said, well, so how do we get back to the table? How do we get back to the feast? How does that happen? The answer is found in Luke 15. And so it's good for us and for our souls, our hearts, to sit again in Luke 15. So we're in Luke 15, looking at verses 1 to 3 to start with. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, they're over here, they mutter, this man welcomes sinners and he eats with them. And then verse 3 says, Jesus told them this parable. As we know, he tells three stories, three parables here. One about a shepherd, one about a woman, one about a father. And yet they are one story. Jesus so masterfully weaves the elements of each story together that when we stand back and look at it, as we're going to do this morning, one more time, as we look at it one more time, we will see the most shocking facet of these stories. And then we will know how the older brothers and the older brother-ish can find their seat at the table. In all three stories, you recall, something of great value is lost. A sheep, a coin, two sons. And in each story, they end up with much rejoicing. The shepherd calls his associates and they rejoice. The woman calls her associates and they rejoice. And the father calls the whole village and they rejoice. But there is one startling difference in these stories. In the first two stories, someone sets an all-out search for that which is lost. The shepherd leaves 99 sheep and goes looking for the one. The woman leaves 9 coins and goes looking for the one. But when we get to the third story, there's nothing there. No one goes looking. No one does a thing. And so we're left to ask the question, who will go searching? We expect someone to search. It's a bit like a joke, isn't it? When you hear someone start to say, did you hear the one about the Englishman, the Irishman? You expect and the Australian to turn up. Like, you expect three. It's a bit like, you know, did you hear the one about the Englishman, the Irishman and the Australian? They all walked into a pub and the barman looked at them and said, what's this, some sort of joke or what? It's as good as it gets. I've had one coffee, it had soy milk in it, not enough charge. But you expect a third one to come. If someone was to come to you and say, did you hear the one about the Englishman and the Irishman, and they told a joke, you'd go, you're missing something. You need to go back to the playground at school and learn how to tell jokes proper, because they come in threes. Why is there not a third one here? Is it that Jesus all of a sudden has a seniors moment? Like, he is the Ancient of Days. Does he have a seniors moment right here? Has he forgotten to put it in? Well, no, quite the reverse, actually. He's put his stories in such a way that he wants us to wrestle with this question. Shouldn't someone have gone looking? And who should that have been? Like, particularly if we discover that we are older brothers, or that our heart has an older brotherish tendency, who is going to look for us? Will someone say to us, like we say to the younger brothers, no matter what you've done, no matter what you've become, come home? Who will say that to us? Who will search for us? Well, to first century ears, and even to our own ears, we would really expect the older brother in the story to go looking for his younger brother. I mean, that was pretty clearly laid out at the beginning of the Bible. You remember where the first two brothers existed? Cain was the oldest, Abel the youngest. They bring sacrifice before God. God accepts Abel's sacrifice, but not Cain's. Cain gets really irritated. Cain, you remember, kills his brother Abel. God turns up. God says, where is your brother? Cain says, am I my brother's keeper? And the answer from that moment in time, all the way through until the end of time, the answer to the question, am I my brother's keeper, is yes. And so we expect the older brother to go looking. People have expected older brothers to do that since Cain killed Abel. At least that's what a young boy's, he understands it. His name is Jack Payne. He's an 11-year-old boy, lives in South Australia. Just 4 weeks ago, his 4-year-old brother was attacked by a dog near their St. Mary's Park home in South Australia. The dog was so vicious it ripped a section of flesh off his younger brother's head, revealing his skull, bit into his left ear, left bite marks on his face, his arm and his legs. The dog was so big and so vicious, the only thing that Jack could think to do was to drive his bike into the dog in order to get the dog to leave his younger brother alone. People in St. Mary's Park are hailing Jack as a hero. Jack's response is, you know, I'm just his older brother and it's my job to look after my younger brother. And we go, yeah, that's right. That's right. First century ears would have expected the older brother to go looking. But in this story that Jesus tells, the older brother is nothing like this 11-year-old boy. Nor is he like the shepherd in the story that Jesus told. Nor is he like the woman in the story that Jesus told. They mounted all-out searches, but not this older brother, not the older brother in the story that Jesus tells. The older brother should have been like Daniel's older brother. In 1964, Daniel was a pilot for the United States, flying over Vietnam, doing a reconnaissance mission. His plane went down and the army couldn't find him. News got back home to Daniel's older brother. Daniel's older brother sold everything that he had, left his wife and their children with $20, and went to Vietnam to search for his younger brother. A month after his plane went down, Daniel's older brother was walking through the theater of war looking for his brother, dodging Viet Cong fire, dodging Vietnam fire. He didn't have a bed to call his own. He didn't even have a blanket to wrap around himself at night. He had nowhere to call home. He just went looking for his younger brother. His search was so well known, so famous, it became legendary that both the Vietnam soldiers and the Viet Cong soldiers called him the brother. In Jesus' story, in Luke 15, verse 12, if you have a look at it, the older brother in the story has enough resources to go looking for his younger brother, because the property was divided between the two sons. So this older brother had enough. He should have gone to his dad and said, "Dad, my younger brother is a fool. His life has gone down the toilet. I'm going to go looking for him. I'm going to bring him home. I will take my inheritance and use whatever I need to use in order to find him and bring him back to the family." That's what the older brother should have done. The younger brother had looked for pleasure and all he got was pain. He had looked for freedom but found bondage. He was in need of an older brother, but all he got was a Pharisee. And at that point, I don't know about you, but at that point, you know, something in me goes, "Oh, that hurts. There are family members that I'm not as diligent with as I should be." There are hundreds of thousands of people who live within 10 kilometres of where your bottom is placed this morning who do not know Jesus. They're all younger brothers on a path of self-discovery, at the end of which we know the answer. It's they won't discover themselves, they discover that they are not who they thought they should be. Across the creek here, there are 3,000 residents in the retirement villages. I am told 1,500 of them do not know Jesus. And so a question comes. Have we used all the resources at our disposal to mount an all-out search for the younger brothers? And of course, you might say to me, "John, that doesn't help me find a seat at the Father's table, because my heart is older brother-ish and I'm struggling with that right here, right now. So how do I get back over there? How does that work? Will someone say to me, no matter what you have done, no matter what you have become, and you have become very, very good, but apparently that's not right. Will someone say to me, no matter what you've become, come home? Will someone say that to me?" It's a great question. It's the question that we're meant to wrestle with as we look at Luke 15. And as we wrestle with it, we can't help but take this question and the ones associated with it to the storyteller of Luke 15. And as we look at him with our questions, we discover that the answer to our questions is right under our very nose. Because if we follow the trail back from verse 28, you look in verse 28, the father has to come out from the feast to beg, plead with his son, his oldest son, to come back in. As we look at verse 28 and work backwards, we see that the one who pleads for the older son is the same one who sits with these sinners and tax collectors. It's the same one who runs for the younger brother. It is none other really, in reality, than Jesus. It's the same voice, verse 28, verse 20, and the same one who sits in chapter 15, verses 1 and 2. It's Jesus. This is the shocking piece of the story, because Jesus is the one who mounts an all-out, relentless search for younger brothers and older brothers. That makes Jesus the true elder brother. You staying with me here? The younger brothers are those who take the path to self-discovery. They're like the younger son in the parable. The older brothers are the ones who take the path of self-improvement. They're like the older brother in the parable. The younger brothers are the sinners and tax collectors who are very, very bad sitting around Jesus. The older brothers are the Pharisees and the teachers of the law who are very, very good. And then Jesus is the true elder brother, because he has set out on a search that will not let anything stop it. And it's costly. The cost begins when as he sits with sinners and tax collectors, for his name is dragged through the mud. But the shame goes up a notch or two as he extends his hands to the Pharisees over here, saying, "But I want you to come and sit at my table too." He extends a hand of grace to his enemies, who will take not just one hand, but they will take both hands and drive the cost of the search up a notch or two, because they will take both hands and nail both of them to a cross. And when Jesus is hanging on the cross, they don't give to Jesus what the true elder brother should have. They don't give him the best robe. They ensure he's stripped naked for all the world to see. They don't give him the ring of the true son. They ensure that he wears a crown of thorns. They don't give him any fattened calf to eat. They make sure he drinks the cup of God's wrath for the sins of the younger brothers and the older brothers. So there's no other way for any of us to find a seat at the table unless the true elder brother spends everything he has, down to the last drop of his blood, to get us a seat. He is stripped naked so that we can be clothed with the dignity of grace. He is made to wear a crown of thorns so that we might receive a crown of life. He is made to drink the cup of God's wrath so that we can feast at the Father's table. And Jesus did it willingly, just like the woman and just like the shepherd in Jesus' story. But more than that, Jesus is the shepherd. In Ezekiel chapter 34, God speaks through the prophet Ezekiel. Ezekiel 34 verses 15 and 16, God says, "I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord." Listen to this. "I will search for the lost and bring back the strays. I will bind up the injured and the strengthen the weak. I will shepherd the flock with justice." And he's absolutely willing. From Isaiah's lips, Isaiah 53 and verse 5, we're told that the iniquity, that our sins, our iniquity was put on Jesus. He took our punishment. He was crushed when we should have been. Why? Because he wants us all to sit at the Father's table one day and to enjoy all that the Father has to offer. So how can the older brothers and the older brother-ish, how can we, if our hearts are older brother-ish, find a seat at the table? It's by accepting the hand of grace from Jesus, nail-pierced now, who says, "No matter what you've done, no matter what you've become, come home. Come home," he says. "Come home." What we need to do is take the hand of the storyteller and come home. To do that, we first of all need to empty our hands of the scorecards that so many of us keep. They're in our hands and in our pockets. They're wrapped around our hearts. Scorecards which say things like, look how I sacrificed for my children. I made sure they had something to eat even though I did not. Look at how many years and how many hours I've sacrificed working long hours to provide for my family, God. Look. God, I did not fall pregnant out of wedlock like the young people do nowadays. Look. Look, God, I didn't get drunk like he did. Look how good I have been, God. See my scorecard? When we bring scorecards like this to the cross on which the Son of God hangs, we begin to see our scorecards for what they're worth. Are they not a silliness before the God on a cross? How can these sacrifices compare with that one? And the clarity of what these are is made crystal clear when we recall one of the most graphic verses in the scriptures. Let me read it to you. It's from Isaiah chapter 64. Isaiah 64 and verse 6. This is what the prophet said as he spoke about himself and his people. All of us have become like one who is unclean. Now listen to this. All our righteous acts, all our scorecards are like filthy rags. Filthy rags. Now, this is graphic. The word that left Isaiah's lips are far more graphic than the word that came from our publisher's printer. Filthy rags here is used menstrual cloths. If you're horrified by that, you're getting somewhere near what our scorecard is like before the God on a cross. Who would bring a handful of those and say, look, here's my scorecard? Who would do that? When Paul the Apostle was not converted, he was an older brother. He was literally a Pharisee. He tells us in Philippians chapter 3 and verse 6 that his scorecard was perfect. He says, as to legalistic righteousness, I was faultless. He then says two verses later in chapter 3 verse 8, but all of my scorecard, all of my legalistic righteousness, all of my heritage, I count as loss that I might know Jesus. And then he says, I count it all as refuse, the NIV says. And again, the word that left Paul's pen is much more graphic than our publishers would have us believe. The word refuse is the word, it's the shortened word of Schweppes. You know the word that people say when they hit their thumb with a hammer or slam it in a car door. They go, Schweppes, or the shortened form. That's the word Paul uses when he says refuge. I count my perfect scorecard as a load of Schweppes. Who would bring a pocketful of feces and say, look, God, this is my scorecard. It's faultless. It's perfect. Can you see? This is the best I can do. Well, at least it's better than his. For older brothers to come to the table, they have to empty their pockets, strip stuff off their heart, empty their hands of used menstrual cloths and feces so that they can then take the nail-pierced, gracious hand of the true elder brother and come home. It's the only way that we can do that. before the cross of God, the older brother's voice, look, look at my scorecard, becomes quite shallow, doesn't it? And it's pathetic. It's an empty voice. It's the voice of one who's looked down their nose at others with judgmentalism and fault-finding for years. And at that point, we may expect to hear God say to us, what were you thinking, bringing me that scorecard? Maybe we expect to hear that. But that's not what we hear. When Jesus is on the cross, one of his prayers goes like this. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And you know, there's a fascinating heart change right there. Not in Jesus, but in one of the thieves to his side. There were two thieves crucified, do you remember that? Just moments before Jesus prayed that prayer, both thieves are hurling insults at Jesus. Save yourself, save us. But when Jesus prays, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do, one of the thieves has a heart change. And he starts to say, Jesus, will you remember me? You don't deserve to be here, but I do. Will you remember me? There wasn't a miracle. There wasn't an epiphany. All this thief heard was the prayer of the Christ who prayed from a gracious heart. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Their scorecards don't amount to a heap of dung. But forgive them. And that's all that's needed. Whenever a man stands at the foot of the cross where God is on it, that's all a man needs. When a woman stands at the foot of the cross that has a God on it, that's all a woman needs. Words of forgiveness from a gracious God. It is enough. It always is enough. And when you see the true elder brother's sacrifice, when you see Jesus' willing sacrifice, when you see he paid the price for our freedom with his most precious blood, even down to the last drop, to secure us a seat at the table, when we see that, we will no longer stand before Jesus or before his people or before the world with handfuls and pocketfuls of used menstrual cloths and feces and say, this is my scorecard. We will drop it all and say, I don't deserve anything that God would give, but with empty hands, I will take everything he brings. And then we'll be able to sing with an Anglican minister words that have been known for 300 years almost. His name was Augustus Toplady. And in 1776, he penned these words. Nothing in my hand I bring, simply to thy cross I cling. Naked come to thee for dress, helpless look to thee for grace. Foul, I to the fountain fly. Wash me, Saviour, or I die. And when our hearts are in that place, when we can sing a hymn like that with integrity, when we no longer rely on self, no longer even want to hold a scorecard, when we are in that place, then we are no longer fearful of God. Then we will find the life-giving grace of God, and it will fill our hearts that they might beat with gratefulness once more. And that has been the testimony of countless older brothers and older brother-ish for millennia. It is my testimony. And it's my prayer that it would be your testimony once more this morning. When you see the wonder of the Father's grace, when you see the hand of Jesus extended out to even the older brothers and the older brother-ish, then the pathway to the Father's table is really clear, isn't it? Empty your hands and receive. Let me pray. Father of all, we give you thanks and praise that when we were still far off, you met us in your Son and brought us home. Dying and living, he declared your love, gave us grace and opened the gate of glory. May we who share Christ's body live his risen life. We who drink his cup bring life to others. We whom the Spirit lights give light to the world. Keep us in this hope that we have grasped, so that we and all your children shall be free, and the whole earth live to praise your name.